This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. You've been hearing about it for a long time, but it really is here. The new Renegade University. We're calling it RU 2.0. It features a new website, a new platform, our own independent social media, many new video courses, reboots of old video courses, our new office hours feature, which enables you to talk one-on-one with our instructors via Zoom teleconferencing, or to hold your own seminars with them. You'll find on our new website also a listing of all of our RU Live events. That's our RU weekends, daily seminars, and other events that we host. Go to our new website, renegadeuniversity.com, and for the next week, you'll get 30 to 40% off memberships. That's renegadeuniversity.com, and we hope to see you in class. This episode is about the relationship between virtue and freedom. Does virtue require a restriction of freedom and a restriction of who we are? Or is virtue necessary to maintain the freedoms that we all value? I can think of no one better qualified to answer these questions than my guest this week, who is the author of multiple volumes on the history of what we call bourgeois virtues. And she is also the author of a memoir called Crossing, about her transition from being Donald to being Deirdre. This is my interview with Deirdre McCluskey. So I'm here in downtown Chicago in a beautiful apartment that is my honor to inhabit for a moment here with the great Deirdre McCluskey. And it's an honor in many ways, but you represent a lot of things to a lot of people. And I wanted to begin with your beginning, because we like to do on this show a lot of biographical work in addition to intellectual work. And we like to merge the two to help explain why people think the way they do.
I can't understand most thinkers unless I know their biography. I mean, there's an excellent German translated biography of Kant, which finally got me into Kant. I started to understand Kant when I learned, by the way, that he was gay.
Was he?
Which this book skirted around.
No.
Oh, boy, was he gay.
Emmanuel. I mean, he was so dry and boring. How could he have been gay?
Well, his friend, Mr. Green, a merchant from Hull who lived in East Prussia, he met the guy and fell in love with him, obviously, turned down an offer that week from Halle, which was the best university in Germany at the time, on the grounds that, well, I have too many friends here. And then he spent every afternoon and evening for 20 years with Mr. Green.
Just talking. are you trying to queer Immanuel Kant, Deirdre? Is that what's going on here?
I'm, and also my hero, Adam Smith, I'm almost sure was gay.
So you're just queering all of them, huh?
They're queering all of them.
All right.
That's my job.
You go. That's what you do. That's why we love you. All right, back to you. Stop dodging the question. So where did you begin?
Well, I was a guy. I was a boy. Until age 53, I was married for 30 years to the love of my life. I have a couple of grown children who haven't spoken to me since I changed gender in 1995. But I was the son of a Harvard professor and an opera singer, although she didn't sort of complete her career. She's very promising. So I was in a very, very, very privileged environment. Fortunately, I stuttered, which I think helped me not be as arrogant as I possibly could be, because I was not a perfect person, I understood very early. I went to Harvard College, worked in the highway department in Wakefield, Massachusetts, in the summertime. So I, I sometimes stop and watch them raking asphalt when they do it, and I stand there, and this old woman is watching them, and they think, I imagine that she's watching them for their physique. No, no, no. I'm watching their technique. They don't get it. So I went straight from Harvard College to Harvard Graduate School, which probably wasn't a very good idea. But flourished there because I went into economic history. I like dead people. The more dead, the better.
Me too.
I love them.
Because we don't have the same feelings for them. I've been thinking about this recently.
Really?
I was just thinking about this. Why do I love history so much?
Yeah.
I think in part it's because I don't have those kinds of personal connections with these people. So yeah. I don't mind if they get assassinated when they're 35 or if they get run over by a truck or they have some tragedy happen to them. Right?
You know, Acton said that all great men are bad. Yet one can read a biography of Napoleon. This is in line with your theme, who caused, havoc for 20 years
sure
in Europe, killing millions
mass
of
murderer.
People. A mass murderer with a certain equanimity. You're right. Blood-stained. I read a entry of quite good popular biography of Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
Same point.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to Donald Trump for 10 seconds, and I can't stand it.
Really?
Drives me nuts.
How could this be? You're a libertarian. Libertarians don't care about this silly stuff. Why do you care about Donald Trump?
I care about...
Actually, I know why. This is a leading question.
He's a tyrant. He wants to be a tyrant. That's why he loves tyrants.
Uh-huh.
It's not just that he's foolish. I mean, lots of people are foolish. But he's a real danger. When he falls, as he will fall either in the United States Senate, well, now it looks doubtful, but or in the election, I think that'll be a blow to right-wing populism internationally, because I think they've been inspirited by this guy who goes around hugging them. And all the tyrants and populists of the right are his pals.
Okay, so you know what I was thinking, but maybe I'm wrong because this is not what you were saying. I assumed, because you are the scholar of bourgeois virtue.
I am indeed.
You are indeed, and you, I would say,
so I claim,
have a more or less positive take on bourgeois virtue.
Oh, you bet.
Right. I assumed you don't like Trump because he is the anti-bourgeois.
No. No, in fact, he's a very bad bourgeois.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
I mean, as Bloomberg said during the campaign, he said, look, this guy is not a good businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomberg himself was a poor boy who made good, whereas this guy got $400 million from his dad, which he pissed away.
Right.
He'd be richer now if he had put it in the stock market and left it there. He actually would be.
Right.
So, he's not a good businessman. He's not, and then all the qualities that I admire in the liberal bourgeoisie that Adam Smith admired, although it's the case that in The Wealth of Nations you can't find a single nice statement about people in business.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting. Hmm. He wasn't a craven, what can I say, uncritical observer, but he was making, Adam Smith was, an ethic for a commercial society.
Mm-hmm.
And the very high percentage of business people who follow it, come on, they're my heroes.
They are your heroes.
Because they've made us rich and reasonably good. It's so easy to take, the few who go wrong, the Jeff's Skillings of the world, and say, oh yeah, that's what they're like. They're as Marx said, they're a bunch of creeps.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe necessary creeps, as he also said, but creeps.
I think we actually do agree. So my argument is that Trump is almost the perfect anti-bourgeois.
Of course he is.
Right, and this is, but I'm suggesting that this is why you dislike him so intensely.
Yeah, I do. Well, that's one reason I do. Yeah, although I was fooled by The Art of the Deal. When it came out, I read it, thought, boy, this guy's really, I didn't say he's a wonderful man. I knew he was a jerk even then. Everyone did. But I thought, The Art of the Deal. Well, it turns out it was fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
This poor man who wrote it now goes around railing against Trump.
Yep.
He's having to apologize for making him a big star, which he did.
So since you're the expert on bourgeois virtue, explain what it is.
Well, it's the ordinary virtues, not ordinary so much as the virtues that all cultures admire. The way I talk about it is called in philosophy departments virtue ethics, And it's the in the West, it's the four so-called cardinal virtues of the pagan world, prudence, temperance, justice, and courage, to which are added, somewhat uncomfortably, I must say, the three so-called Christian or theological virtues, which, by the way, doesn't mean that Christians actually practice them. Mm-hmm. Faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And those seven have commercial versions. And we, you know, if you examine the last couple of pages of my first big book about this, called The Bourgeois Virtues, it's a kind of a short sermon on these seven virtues and how they're commercial, how they can be. Courage is an easy one. Obviously, enterprise of various kinds is courageous. You know, you start a hairdressing salon in the neighborhood, you think it'll succeed, and you're putting your heart and soul into it. I mean, it's a courage that's not just battlefield courage. And so with all the virtues, faith being integrity or identity, hope being forward-looking, having a project, all these are not reducible to prudence, which is what the economists think. Prudence is a virtue. You can call it self-interest if you want. But it's not the only virtue. And to try to kind of, as many social scientists do, try to make it all into prudence and forget about this love stuff, with scare quotes, you know, love, is a foolish enterprise, which I once approved of and now don't.
Love?
No, not love, but the enterprise of making love into, oh, you're just doing it for... Actually, Hobbes does this. It's quite striking. Thomas Hobbes writes, love is just what pleases us. It's like Jeremy Bentham or Gary Becker, Posner, the Judge Posner, or whatever.
So what's your position on love?
That it's a distinct and unfungible or irreducible.
It cannot be made commercial. Is that what you mean?
No, it's not so much that it can't be made commercial. I mean, Love for Sale, a great jazz standard. No, it's that it's separate from prudence. I presented some of this at the American Economic Association meetings, and this young, bright economist put up his hand and said, well, look, can we take all these other virtues and put them in the utility function, which is what economists talk about, which is to reduce everything to Benthamite pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you married? He said, yeah, I'm married. I said, suppose you went home this afternoon and said to your wife, I love you because you give me pleasure. I love you because you increase my utility. How would she react? And he was an intelligent guy. He said, boy, that would be a dumb thing to say. And it certainly would.
Right.
Because, you know, courage and temperance and justice and faith, hope, and love and so on, they're all part of it. And you can't, I mean, they obviously have connections with each other. You can love in an imprudent way, which is bad for you and bad for everyone. Hitler loved Germany. Mm-hmm. But you have to, here's the point. In the 18th century, there's a lot of talk about reducing ethical thinking to some
science,
little formula.
To science,
in the old sense of a systematic inquiry with Occam's razor and everything, making things as simple as possible. So Hobbes in the century before, and the other end of this long century, Bentham reduced it to pleasure. And Kant reduced it to justice, and Locke and others reduced all virtues to an analogy with exchange, the equality, another form of justice, of exchange. And those are all crazy. In every culture, one knows, the way you be a good person is you become a good person virtue by virtue, avoiding vice by vice, and then go ahead and do what you do. I mean, that's actually how human psychology works, and there's a good deal of evidence that that's so. And to go off and say, oh, no, it's all prudence. No, it's all justice. Which one is it? You know, great taste. What is it? The great taste, low calories, whatever the advertising slogan is.
So, I mean, this is all these thinkers you're talking about are all Enlightenment thinkers.
They are indeed.
Right. And they are also writing at the dawn, I suppose, of capitalism, the rise
no,
of capitalism.
No, that's
are
not
are there precursors at least?
No, there's no precursor.
You don't think there's you don't think the Enlightenment and capitalism have any relationship?
They have no relation at all.
Okay, so that's you stand. I mean, I might agree with you, but just so the audience is clear, that you are bucking a major trend in academia, right? Like most historians do tightly link the two.
Yeah, it's foolish.
So go for it.
And the basic problem is the fixed idea, which we got in a way, alas, from Adam Smith, my hero. And Montesquieu, that there are stages in history.
Right.
And then it got into Marx, and then everyone adopted it. And then there's supposed to be this capitalist stage. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at archaeology or anthropology or ancient literature or anything, you find that's not true. It's not the case that capitalism is new. Of course, it depends what you mean by capitalism. But if you mean accumulation of capital, come on, the Chinese accumulated capital in the Great Wall and the Great, the Grand Canal and so forth.
Okay.
The Romans, Roman roads, come on, capital. The Acheulean hand axe is this thing that about the size of, you can put in your hand with a sharp edge that you can throw at the hyenas trying to eat the antelope you're trying to scavenge. Humans accumulated Acheulean hand axes for 1.3 million years, including us, including Homo sapiens. And in archaeological sites, you find sometimes hundreds of them. So they were busily away making sharp their stone. So that's not it. Oh, well, let's see. Is it greed?
Hmm.
Come on.
Right.
Even Max Weber said that was nonsense.
Clearly, right.
And people have been greedy. You don't have to, all you need to read is the Bible to know that. Is it mass production?
That's what I was getting at.
Nope. Fish sauce was mass produced at Rome and went all over the empire.
True.
In China, there was
true
detailed division of labor in, say, the making of silk cloth for two millennia. So this whole idea that there's something really special in those respects to the modern world is crazy. What is special is what people mostly neglect or merge with capital, namely technology,
okay,
ideas,
okay,
containerization, which involved no science at all. 1956, a man named man in North Carolina named McLean
put a lot of people out of jobs.
It sure did, and then it made a lot of jobs.
Yes.
So it's not jobs we're maximizing anyway; it's income, it's
right
consumption.
Exactly.
So that's what's special about the modern world.
Okay.
And people get it all wrong. The very word capitalism is the problem. It's a scientific error compressed into a single word. There are lots of those lying around the intellectual world. Words as Humpty Dumpty said, "Who's to be the master?"
Mm-hmm.
And we're mastered by this word capitalism. Because you think, oh well, even economists are. They say capital accumulation, that's where it is. No, it's not. It's new ideas.
Well, hang on. Right, the new ideas included these bourgeois virtues.
Not really. They too existed in ancient times. It's just, and here's what really changed. It's not that the bourgeoisie got suddenly virtuous. I haven't made this clear to people, because very fancy scholars who know all about this get it wrong all the time.
Hmm.
And I've taken to saying it practically every time I say anything. No, I say, it's not that the bourgeoisie got greedier or saved more or worked harder or even became more ingenious. It's that the rest of the society started to approve of it.
Yes, the ascendancy of bourgeois virtues.
The ascendancy
virtues
of yes bourgeois virtues
yes
is the point.
Yes.
And they're not really ascendant even now, because
right,
great masses of the clerics, of the professoriate and the journalists still hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that makes
them... they live according to them, though, largely.
Of course they do.
Right, okay.
Of course they do.
Right. Okay. So, I'm assuming you're aware of Daniel Bell's thesis.
I am.
Yes. About the cultural contradictions of capitalism, or at least what he claims to be the cultural contradictions of capitalism. I've been waiting to ask you this question for about 5 years, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to describe how I read his thesis,
okay,
and we'll see if you agree with my reading, because it's a difficult essay.
It's very difficult.
It's not entirely transparent.
But look, I myself try to be transparent in everything I write,
yeah,
and then people come up to me and say, oh, you're in favor of communism. No, wait, you misunderstood.
No, you are highly accessible, certainly compared to Daniel Bell.
Okay.
So in his very famous essay, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, which became a very famous book as well, it changed my life, by the way, argument. Yeah, I see capitalism through this lens.
Yeah.
Except that he comes out, I think he frames it correctly, but he comes out with a different position on it. But anyway, so his thesis is, I think, quite brilliant, even if it's wrong, that capitalism produces two contradictory cultural forms, which he calls hedonism and Puritanism.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So the Puritanism is necessary for the production side.
Nonsense.
Hang on. Deirdre, just slow down there. I know you're going to crush it in a second. Hang on. So Bell says, you know, to build a factory, to get workers to work in the factory for 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 hours a day, you need to be puritanical. You need to repress these urges inside of you. You're just chomping at the bit over there. Just hang on. It requires tremendous discipline.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why Puritans were so good at it, and their descendants, and those who have adopted especially puritanical virtues, which are highly bourgeois in those ways.
She's
shaking her head all the way through this. It's a good thing I'm citing another scholar, not my own, not my own work. But that the amazing thing, according to Bell, is that nonetheless, and this is sort of an ironic contradiction, it's a very ironic contradiction, what has been produced, certainly since the rise of consumer capitalism at the turn of the 19th century, nonsense. Turn of the 20th century, nonsense. She's still saying nonsense, has been the production of goods and services that have fed or gratified hedonistic appetites.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So we have the end of the 19th century, the rise of Coney Island, mass production, department stores, so people can buy all these baubles and perfumes that they don't need. The Puritans would never approve of.
Of course.
And then, of course, we have worse stuff happening in the 20th century, the rise of pornography.
Terrible. And, you know, just awful. As though there wasn't any pornography.
Exactly.
In the 16th century.
Well, there was pornography, certainly, but not at this scale.
And you've one-third of the books produced in Europe were pornography.
She just busted it already. Wow, that was quick. So much for Daniel Bell. Okay, I guess I would say where there was mass production of pornography in a capitalist via a capitalist mode of production pre-modern, in the pre-modern era, I'll just assume you're right on that, that this existed. It's an epistemological fact or empirical fact. I would say then that Bell's thesis would hold there and then in those places. No, you didn't have that contradiction between Puritans in the world or puritanical types in the world, bourgeois types and the hedonistic types?
No, it's an old problem in thinking about the history of the United States in particular.
Right.
And let me put it this way. Well, it's not quite true. I was going to say no one in Europe would say this. But that's not quite true, because they had their own Puritans. And certainly Max Weber's way of looking at it in his great book, one of the great books of the last couple of centuries, the Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, fits with this Bell thesis.
Exactly.
But it's wrong, too. I mean,
They're
both completely wrong.
You know that all of my thinking is based hinges on those two books?
I know. Okay, that's true of most intellectuals. It's true. You need to read my books. Most intellectuals just start with that. They start with the idea that what's important about what they call capitalism, and I told you why I don't think that's a smart idea, is rationality.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
This is a point that Weber made very strongly,
right.
Iron Cage and all that talk. And this is baloney, as I've shown in my books. It's just crazy. People are rational. If they're starving to death, they're very rational. They have to be really careful. I have old work from the 1970s and 80s on English open fields, where I show that these ignorant peasants who couldn't read in England scattered their fields, scattered their plots as insurance. And then I show quantitatively that it was, they did it pretty much exactly as, I don't know, a portfolio manager would have told them to do it. So, and there's a whole school of economic development thinking. The great Theodore Schultz was its leader, which says, look, poor people are not irrational. There's no new birth of rationality. That's one thing. The problem in American history is we keep blaming the Puritans for things. And this is slightly crazy.
Oh, no.
They were a small group, even in the colonies. And within a couple of generations, as Weber himself admits, they stopped being Puritans. Benjamin Franklin was the son of a believing Puritan, actually, and an immigrant from England who was a Puritan. Yet Benjamin Franklin, who's Max Weber's famous example of, what does he call it? He's got some phrase for it, secular, I think it's something like secular Puritanism, I can't remember right now. But but the Puritans themselves weren't Puritans in the sense that people want to believe. Hardworking, especially hardworking, especially disapproving of pleasure. These are people who bundled their kids together before they were married. Mm-hmm. They did it routinely. Mm-hmm. These are people who made, you know, beer and wine to the extent they could in New England. Come on, they were very jolly people. They weren't, an excellent sort of, parallel of this is a much more important one in history is the Dutch Republic in the Golden Age of the 17th century, where, you know, there's this embarrassment of riches. Mm-hmm. And that I can see that, and there's a good deal of evidence for that, and I think it's all right. But in the meantime, they were buying in the number of a million ordinary people were buying these luscious oil paintings of bunches of flowers that couldn't exist in the world because they didn't bloom the same time.
Exactly.
This was a luxury civilization. And here's the problem. Here's the basic problem. All civilizations are luxury civilizations. This is something, this consumerism idea is ridiculous. Mm. Ask any anthropologist. Talk to any anthropologist, any cultural anthropologist, and they tell you, well, of course, food and eating and dressing and makeup and so on, ornamentation, is all of it luxury. You don't, you know, come on, this you can see this in all kinds of ways. So it's not the case that consumerism is a special characteristic of modern rich people or even ordinary people, right, in rich countries. That's right. All baloney. There's no capitalism. There's nothing. What's creative about capitalism is letting people try things out. That's what worked.
And that's exactly the problem. Once you let them try things out, the next thing you know, you have Pornhub and you have everybody watching pornography instead of just a few hundred years ago who could watch or read pornography.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, when I was a kid, all the boys would have copies of Playboy under their bed.
Of course.
But, okay, it served the same function. The amount of masturbation they did, I imagine, was more or less the same. Yes, we can drive faster. We can fly instead of taking ships. We can eat more. We have computers and so on, blah, blah, blah. So we can do all these things better. We can, and that our tastes are sometimes bad in modern times is just what they were in ancient times. People read pornography, if they could get hold of it, in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's notorious that they did. They went instead of going to violent movies. They went to places. They went to the Colosseum where you actually slaughtered people, mm-hmm, for their amusement. So there's nothing new about this.
No, but the conflict, I think, that Bell is claiming to exist within capitalism, I see in those societies too. In Rome, very famously, it fell. And the old argument is that it fell because of its decadence.
Yeah, no, that's
so the mass production
false.
Of decadence
no,
is,
it didn't
has
fall
been blamed
because
for
of
that.
Its decadence. That's a Spartan argument.
Exactly.
In the 18th century, for reasons that just baffle me, many, many political thinkers admired Sparta. Mm-hmm. Now, the place in ancient Greece that I admire is Athens or Syracuse, mm-hmm, places where things were going on. Sparta was just a military camp,
right,
and yet they loved it. And they talked about it all the time in just these terms. Sure. The soft feminine.
Yep.
So always masculine is
very much so.
The
yes.
theme on this.
Yep.
Yeah, we got to be tough. And we got the Roman Empire. You notice they got soft. They became, as Gibbon famously said, Christian. That was their damn problem.
It was very gendered, you're right.
This gospel of love, this queer business, that's a lot of
exactly.
nonsense.
Yeah.
That's why they got defeated.
That's right.
They got defeated because there was an enormous population expansion of Germans. Mm. It had nothing to do with the decadence. Mm. It was a highly... They were not Spartan enough. That is, the Roman Empire that we think of this great military dictatorship on the model of China now or something like that, it was very... The percentage of the empire's population that were in the army was very small. And one of the reasons they had to have Roman roads is they needed to move the legions very quickly from Scotland to Syria. if things started to go south in Syria. But they had a small army, and to be sure, those were often the sources of the emperors. And there was a lot of palace murder and violence. But, you know, no, it's not. Now, look, what I think is correct about his argument is and he, I don't think he emphasizes this enough. He's a materialist, like all of us have been since Marx. And he believes that it's these real events that matter. What I think's correct about the argument is that rich societies generate a lot of intellectuals. And the intellectuals form a class, a whole new class. Not a whole new class. Again, as I often say as a historian, we've seen it before. In earlier times, it was often the priests who were the equivalent of this. But in any case, the clerisy, as I call them, from a German word, railing against their fathers, and to an extraordinary degree, the major figures of the left and the right criticism of capitalism, so-called, I call it innovism, which is a much better word, in the 19th century were the sons of the bourgeoisie.
Across the board.
I mean, across the board. Yep. There are dozens of examples of this, fathers and sons.
And wealthy.
And wealthy, yeah, yeah.
Or at least of the wealthy class.
Well, sure. They were.
Upper class people.
Marx's father was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. We all know about Engels. Mm-hmm. It wasn't he, and so forth. And it's not just them. It's a whole series of them.
Right.
And so there's a, what would you call it? Liberalism, which I think is the spring of the modern world.
Classical.
Classical, but I want to drop the word classical and just keep calling it liberalism. Yep. Because Americans have... Sure. Actually, South Americans too, have grossly distorted the word. But anyway, classical liberalism, if you want. As people keep pointing out, Isaiah Berlin and others pointed this out, doesn't have protections against criticism. It just says, go ahead, have a blog, go do interview people if you want, feel free, let a thousand flowers bloom. And whereas all other systems that have been tried from time to time have very strict control over the intellectuals. And this means that a bunch of guys, ambitious guys, are running around looking for something shocking to say. Mm-hmm. The old formula in journalism is simplify and then exaggerate. Mm-hmm. And so it was.
Yeah. Okay. You just... ran a truck through everything, I believe, and hold dear. Let me try to recover here, see what I can do. So let's go back to your points about the Puritans
in this
great country of ours, on that eastern coast over there. So you brought up these examples of them doing sort of non-puritanical things, right? Bundling their children. You even missed some, right? So they were great purveyors and distributors and producers of alcohol.
Rum.
There you go.
Eliezer Wheelock was a very pious man, and he went into the wilderness to teach the Indian with a gratis ad pernicum and a Bible and a drum and 500 gallons of New England rum.
Yep. And that's not an exaggeration, most likely, because if anyone who's read my book knows, there was a whole lot of drinking going on, even in Plymouth.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm not sure this challenges Bell's thesis, though, right? Because what we have is this conflict, I think, between hedonism and Puritanism within the Puritans. And I think that conflict becomes exacerbated or compounded with the advent of mass production.
So you're saying that it's the magnitude that's the problem, that you admit, as I keep saying, that consumerism is universal in human societies. From the Bushmen of the Kalahari.
Sure.
From which, by the way, we appear to all have descended. Mm-hmm. It appears to be that in Southwest Africa was the origin of Homo sapiens.
Sure.
So we've always been that way, but then getting really good at it, getting rich, is the problem.
Right.
And I just don't see that. I think that getting rich is a great thing. You know, the old saying, I've been poor and I've been rich, and honey, rich is better, is correct.
I do too.
100%. 100%. And it's...
See, I'm no longer a leftist, so I can say that.
There you are. That's right. All my left... When we were in graduate school, we had a colleague in the economic history workshop who was rich. And we'd have to leave on the board, Charles, call your broker. He would be off at some meeting to overthrow capitalism.
Of course. That's what we do.
That's what we do. So
So they've been consumers all along.
They've been consumers all along.
I agree with you there.
And the enrichment of the world is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Sure.
And on the whole, it hasn't resulted in more corruption than there already was. Hmm. It may have, in my opinion, it's probably made people on average better being rich. Because, you know, how much can you think about the transcendent and the good parts of the transcendent, because there are bad parts, if you're worrying about, if you're really worrying about where your next meal is coming, you're obsessed with your hunger. And so you can't be a Cubs fan or some other hopeless enterprise. You can't do the transcendent that is the, as a great Anglican theologian at the end of the 16th century said, man doth seek a triple perfection, first a physical, then an intellectual. But then there's still something missing, he said. And that's, we need an answer, as I put it, to the question, so what? It's a hard question to answer. And we all need to answer it. And as we get older, we get more and more aware that that's kind of what it's, that's, we really got to answer that question. And it can be God or the family or the nation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are dangerous ones. Or it can be science, art.
So in 1957,
yep.
The Senate, the United States Senate, held hearings on this new phenomenon among youth in America. And the hearings were, hearings was led by Senators John F. Kennedy and Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, yeah.
A great liberal Democrat and a great conservative Republican. The hearings were on the subject of rock and roll music.
I thought it was terrible.
And they denounced rock and roll as being a threat to American civilization.
Yeah.
You are saying here that they were wrong?
Absolutely. I stopped paying attention to popular music 2 years later. I was a folky. Uh-huh. I sang. I know.
No, this is the problem. This is why you don't get Bell's thesis, because you dropped out of pop culture. That's why. Because you're an academic. You don't know this stuff.
I know more socialist songs than any of my socialist friends.
Don't sing them, please.
No, I won't. But every generation has said this. The Athenians.
Yes.
Who... Right. Executed Socrates, yep. Said exactly the same thing.
Agreed. Yeah.
And there's nothing new about it. And I abhor modern rock music. Mm-hmm. It all sounds to me like an airplane crash. But, you know, I'm prepared to admit that I'm ignorant about it.
No, that's fine. No, yeah, I was teasing you about that. But here's what I'm getting at. When the alarm clock goes off at 6 or 7 or 8 in the morning, there's a conflict inside of me.
Yeah.
You know, my body wants to stay in bed.
It sure does. That's the hedonism.
Exactly. And so that sort of comes naturally to me in some ways. But then there's this Puritanism inside my head that says, get up and go to work.
Yeah, well.
And so if my laptop is nearby, it's full of either hedonism and Puritanism because there's just more available, right?
Yeah, but
on both sides. There's more Puritanism available because I can work on the laptop.
I know.
And there's more hedonism available because I can download porn
you
or whatever.
You can eat wonderful candy.
Or watch
candy
TV order candy online.
Exactly.
Order booze online.
That's right. But that's the matter of temperance. Mm-hmm. That's the virtue that you're talking about.
Right.
Or the vice, which is indulgence. Or because what temperance is the virtue of controlling impulses. Mm-hmm. Something that Donald Trump doesn't have at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the great book of the 18th century about temperance is Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which most economists don't even know he wrote.
Yes, very important.
He made his philosophical reputation in Europe in 1759 with that book. And its central theme is that it is educational. In a way that 18th century philosophy, except for Rousseau's crazy theories, went after he had sent his children to the orphanage so that he could write the book in peace, no one talked about education in the 18th century. They acted as though the ethical actor came full-blown adult, an adult male, by the way, and that was the person you needed to deal with. Whereas ancient Mediterranean ethical philosophy was all about education. And Smith was, in some ways, the last of a dying breed there. And it's temperance.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it needs to be worked on. Of course it needs to be admired and watched. And of course you need to say, do you really need that third ice cream? I mean, of course, But we, you know, there's nothing particularly capitalist about it, to use this silly word. Mm-hmm. There's nothing modern about it. Mm-hmm. People flagellating themselves in the Middle Ages mm-hmm. were often blamed for spiritual pride, which is an intemperance. And there's a wonderful old New Yorker cartoon which shows two monks walking in the cloister, and one says to the other, "But I am holier than thou." and Satan leaps in, you know, to take his soul. So we all need temperance.
Okay. So I guess you're saying that this cultural or psychological contradiction inside of us about this, right, between
it's
temperance
human.
And our gluttony.
It's human.
It goes back forever.
It's human.
Okay.
Come on. People going crazy in the woods, killing each other, you know, think of, actually, a beautiful example of this is Golding's novel, his most famous one, where the kids are stranded on the island and they... what's it called?
Right. Anyway, that everyone reads in high school.
That's
Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies.
Right.
And that's a primitive society with very little to consume, so it could quite call it consumerist,
okay. Yep.
Which goes crazy because of intemperance.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. So I grant all that. I think you're right about that. Your empirical claims, I think, stand mm-hmm. up here. Mm-hmm. I see that conflict going all the way back as far as we have recorded history.
Sure.
Certainly, no doubt about it.
Cain and Abel.
I mean, the great Greek philosophers, this is what they, you know, were primarily concerned about.
Did Eve seize the fruit?
Right. Precisely. There you go.
She said to herself, "Boy, this looks good."
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly in the early Christian work, you know, look at St. Augustine, you know, that's what that City of God book is all about.
Well,
it's about controlling the impulses from what he calls the members.
He said famously before all that, he said, "God, make me pure, but not yet."
Yeah, did he?
Yes,
oh, he was a little cheater too, huh?
Yes,
he wasn't so puritanical either.
No, he wasn't.
You little saint, you little naughty saint. Him? Really?
He
Augustine?
Said that. This is a famous remark.
Augustine is like he's the origin of all of repression.
I know, Calvinism
like,
and
yeah,
all that. Yeah, yeah, you're right,
man.
You're right. But
it's,
you know, this was his theory. This wasn't his practice.
So even he couldn't live up to it.
No, he couldn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, so there's people's private lives. There's what they do in private and how they operate. So Ben Franklin was, you know, sort of famously both hedonistic and puritanical, right?
Except he wasn't. It's a complete misunderstanding
of
Franklin. Franklin was a...
I see him as primarily a Puritan. But.
No. That's you got that from Max Weber. Max,
I got to retort to that, but go ahead.
As his nephew said, mm-hmm. Uncle Max, he was talking about Max Weber, mm-hmm. had no sense of humor. And so when he read Father Abraham's speech, mm-hmm. the famous one that says, "A stitch in time," and blah, 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 all these stupid Benjamin Franklin clothes mm-hmm. sayings strung together, didn't get that Franklin was joking. He didn't get that this was not a serious advice to young people.
Oh.
Now, he had these little things he said, a penny saved is a penny earned. He said it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not racked with guilt about consumption. He didn't have a embarrassment of riches. He wanted to be a gentleman, and he was the son of a chandler.
Mm-hmm.
He was apprenticed as a printer. He was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a gentleman through commercial means.
And hard work. Hard worker. Celebrated for that.
Yeah, he celebrated for it, but he didn't do it.
Okay.
He was a hard worker, as everyone is. People planting rice
I promise you, my son is not a hard worker.
Well, mine too. But then he finally figured out.
Nor was I when I was
How
that
old
age.
Is his son?
My son is 18, yeah.
Well, my son was 18, and he failed. We went to the University of Kansas
mm-hmm.
because he couldn't get into any of the Iowa State colleges because he was in the bottom half of his high school
Me
class.
Too.
And he... his first term GPA was zero.
Good man.
Five courses, five Fs. He spent the rest of his college career making up for it, and then he caught fire.
Mm.
Became an English major
yeah.
and went to graduate school, at least got a master's degree. And,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, Benjamin Franklin worked the way everyone worked. Everyone worked hard. If you didn't, you starved.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm.
starved exactly. Not in the colonies. Few people starved,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't do well. So he did well. He was an ambitious guy right from the beginning, but the way he did it, as you can see from his autobiography, is charm. When he was coming down from Boston, illegally leaving his indenture to his brother as a printer, that was against the law. If there was any way of enforcing it, his brother would have brought him back, mm-hmm. but he couldn't because he went to Philadelphia. on the boat. He says, the governor was on the boat, or the governor's wife, I can't remember which it is, and I, with small, acts of service to her, ingratiated myself. He was a very good practical politician. He said once, I always give the other person more credit than they deserve, because then the job gets done. So he was secretly doing stuff all the time. And then when he, at age 41 or 42 or something, when he got had made this fortune, by getting all the government contracts for printing in Pennsylvania and then in other colonies, his son was the governor, the royal governor of New Jersey. You think he didn't use that connection? Come on. So he was nothing like, I had a friend in business, and she said, in selling stuff, you do the Benjamin Franklin close, it's so-called, which is to claim to people that what they're buying is prudent. Mm-hmm. But that's not Ben.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's not the modern entrepreneur.
Right. Okay. So there's the private life, there's what people do, and I agree with you that in large part, even the most puritanical among us have violated their own codes.
Yeah,
okay,
indeed.
So there's that. There's what we do in our private lives and our personal lives, right? As a historian, this is what I come up against all the time.
Sure.
How do you evaluate some great person, some famous person? You know, was Martin Luther King important because he philandered, because he cheated on his wife, or is it important what he did publicly?
Or he plagiarized his dissertation.
Right, again, is that important, or is it more important what he did publicly?
In my opinion, what he did publicly.
Yeah, exactly. So there's the public person, there's the public Ben Franklin.
The persona, you might say.
Yeah, exactly.
The theatrical
precisely.
Terms.
And also there's an ideology that they are putting forward.
Exactly.
Right,
he was
in public.
A great exponent of it.
Okay, so that, you must admit, the public pronouncements of Ben Franklin and all the Puritans and all the Founding Fathers and Martin Luther King, for that matter, were purely puritanical. Their public pronouncements certainly railed against all the violations of bourgeois norms that we've talked about.
No, I don't think so. I just don't think so. Let me see if I can get.
It seems indisputable to me.
There's a political gain to be gotten, as populists and known formally as demagogues understand, in appealing to the envy of the poor for the rich. And so you get a lot of railing like that. In Louisiana in the 1930s, you get it all over the place. Okay. So there's a rhetorical topic, we say, that you see in the Hebrew Bible over and over and over again.
Indeed.
You rich people, you cheat the poor, oh, you're bad. The prophet Joel is particularly eloquent on this. Huh? Again, okay. Does that mean that they actually massively cheated the poor? No, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that they didn't observe any ethic at all in economic life? No, probably not. Did rich people take advantage? You bet they did. I get very annoyed at this claim that you get... that American politics has been terribly corrupted by money. When in human history have rich people not been powerful?
Sure.
In the Roman Republic, rich people had more votes than poor people. And of course they bought the votes of the poor people to get even more.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? I mean, come on. So there's no internal contradiction of capitalism. There may be an internal contradiction of humans, and I'm willing to admit that.
Okay. Okay.
And then we can go together and study humans in all ages.
Okay.
There's a book, sacred book among the enormous number of the Hindus called the Bharata, in which the hero, I forget his name, is opposed by the Pandava brothers. They're the bad guys, and. And the mother of the Pandavas asks the hero, this guy is good, although not faultless, conflicted, the problem of temperance. And she says to him, why be good? And he answers, you know, if we're not good, then we live the life of cattle.
Right.
And very interestingly, Cicero uses exactly the same phrase, right. Calls it the right of the cattle.
Okay.
So, of course, it's always been.
Okay, you have caused me to take a step not backward, but sideways. Ready?
Ready.
So maybe, and I mean this, maybe it's not so much that Daniel Bell is correct and should be my great influence. It's that what I originally thought is correct, which is that Sigmund Freud is right about this.
Yeah.
So it's not about capitalism per se necessarily.
Yeah, I
think you may have convinced me of this just now.
Well, I agree with
it's
you.
It's that civilization
absolutely
is the issue here. Civilization and its discontents.
Discontents, exactly.
Right. That's so this is what I think what you're saying is that conflict between the id and the ego, right?
Yeah,
between desires of the body and the rationality and the discipline of the mind, right?
The Puritanism of,
exactly, right.
So of the ego.
Right. It certainly predates capitalism. There's no question about that. You're
completely
right about that. But I think you find that conflict heightened in with the development of civilizations, as Freud said. And I think a lot of these conflicts you've been describing are in developed civilizations.
I sort of doubt that part of Freud, although I agree. I'm told, I don't really know enough about psychology to know whether it's correct or not. Freud is not, as you know, is not taken seriously by any modern academic psychologist.
Sure.
Zero.
Sure. Yeah.
And his machinery of ego, id, superego, and so forth.
Sure. It's all sort of rhetorical devices,
it's all,
I think.
Rhetorical devices. But the basic point is that people are intemperate or have a problem
or there's
of
an
temperance.
Intemperate impulse in them.
That's right. That's what temperance is.
Exactly.
It's the control of impulse.
That's
just
right.
As courage is the control of fear.
Right. There's binaries.
It's the virtue of controlling fear.
Yep.
And so temperance. But, you know, it's not as if we didn't know that. We've got conflicts like this all, you know, King David sees Bathsheba, I think it was, who's the wife of one of his generals. I think it's Bathsheba. I can't remember her name exactly. And he's the king. So he says, let's see. Boy, is she nice looking.
There's temptation there.
So he sends the general off to a hopeless cause, and he's killed.
Right.
Oh, how terrible. My general got killed. Say, Bathsheba. I'm not sure it's Bathsheba.
Yeah.
Come,
I think you might be right. Yeah.
Let's go with him. And, you know, come on. These stories about, I mean, that's probably why Freud had such success. Marx had such success because everyone's envious of rich people and angry at them, thinking, why don't they give it to me? What's going on here? You know, if you hit one of these basic human angers or tensions, then you'll get good PR, I guess.
Okay.
And one of the problems that Adam Smith's liberalism has, the stuff that I admire and I think made the modern world, is that it's boring. It says, well, let's be temperate, let's be prudent, let's have proper hope, faith, and love, let's do all these things, sort of in a moderate degree. That's what he says all the time.
Mm-hmm. As does John Locke.
As does John Locke. Mm-hmm. Boring. It's much more interesting to say, you see, we're poor because of those damn rich people, or we're unhappy because of this damn desire we have to sleep with our father or mother. Mm. Right, and that's more exciting.
All right, let's stop talking about civilization and capitalism and get back to you. Have you found that to be a conflict in your own life?
Sure, of course I have.
Okay,
I mean,
between desire and what I would say is expected of you.
Yeah, I think it's a problem in everyone's life.
Sure, but how has it worked in yours? Because the academics I've known, which is many of them, tend to be muted, I would say, in their expression of desire. Does that make sense to you? Does that sound right?
Sure does.
Right? It's funny to talk to a fellow academic who gets what I'm saying here.
Yeah, there's
a muted. They're not full. Often I find them to be not fully human, the way the rest of us are in that way.
They think that scholarship involves being above all careful. For example, that you should never get any fact wrong. If you say that Edward I came to the throne in 1271. Instead of 1272, your fellow historians say, oh, for Christ's sakes, McCleskey, what's wrong with you? Don't you have any standards? And that would be true in all kinds of fields. So there's a kind of caution. Someone called normal science. And normal science is dull normal science, in my opinion, because they're not thinking for themselves. They're just doing the usual shtick. It's Kuhn. I'm Tom Kuhn. And I was trained that way, to be careful and get all the partial derivatives right, and so on and so forth. But I gradually learned to express myself in my scholarship, to be who I was. I mean, Deirdre, for example, from 1995 on, before that, I was Donald, and I'm not ashamed of it. And I was a cheerful person. And as I told you, I was married for a long time and had a good marriage. We helped each other. It was wonderful. That last year was a little hard, I have to admit.
I'm thinking of the academic lecture hall or the academic.
Well, but I come from it. It's the family business. Yeah. My sister is also a professor, and like our father, she's very good at lecturing. Mm-hmm. My mom saw me lecture for the first time about 10 years ago. She was an actress as well as a singer. She said, "Dear, you're an actress because I perform." Mm-hmm. Partly it's because I stutter, and I can't. My father used to memorize his lectures, which I find just unbelievable.
Wow, he did?
Memorize them word for word. Well, he's very nervous. Wow. He had terrible stage fright.
Oh, God.
But he was a famous lecturer at Harvard. I mean, everyone loved him. I still get law professors coming up to me and saying, "Are you related to Robert McCluskey?" "Yeah, yeah, I'm his daughter, so to speak." Wow.
What an awful cross to bear.
It is, for because every summer he spent time rewriting and rememorizing in a very good memory. Mm. His lectures for his famous course, Government 124.
Why didn't he just read them?
Because he couldn't. It was too much for him. He had to memorize it. And if I read, I stutter very badly. Mm. So I finally realized I learned that fairly early, I must say, in my academic career. I have to know what I'm going to say roughly and then stand and deliver, or it doesn't work. I stutter all the time.
Mm. Hmm. I'm thinking of academia, the modern university, as possibly the most, or certainly one of the most bourgeois institutions, just culturally within it. Now, I know that the production, the discourse coming out of universities often is anti-bourgeois in many ways.
Very much
certainly,
so.
And more and more so these days.
Yeah.
Although I think that's sort of new.
All history departments have become left-wing. It's very irritating.
For certain. But I think the culture of those places, I always felt entirely constrained. I felt like I simply couldn't say, not just politically incorrect things, but I couldn't talk about sex, for instance.
But that's not bourgeois. That's not really bourgeois. That's not the bourgeoisie that I admire. I admire the creative bourgeoisie, the bourgeoisie that is willing to talk about sex if there's any money to be made.
Oh.
Who's willing to try out new stuff.
Okay.
Whereas in all science in the old sense, including history and English and so forth, there's tremendous conservatism of method, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And if you deviate from the method and indeed the subject, as you did in your own dissertation, they get mad at you because it threatens their feeble. Again, I mentioned Donald Trump because he's such a wonderful example of a fragile ego going around trying to impose on other people. So that's right. Whereas the good business people, John D. Rockefeller was a very good businessman, and not by screwing other people, as people often think, because he was a very good manager. Mm-hmm. He was consultative, unlike individual one. Mm-hmm. He listened to people. He didn't impose his gut on other people. And he did a good job. Mm-hmm. Made Standard Oil. So Andrew Carnegie. I mean, these are not saints, but they're energetic, creative people who make stuff.
Well, wait. Max Weber said they were saints, in a sense. That was his argument, that John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie, that's who Max Weber was studying when he was writing.
He was.
It was about
he
them.
Was.
It was about the robber barons, the great capitalists.
Yeah.
And he was trying to explain why they would put all this work, all this effort into building these capitalist enterprises and then never enjoy the fruits of their labor. So John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie were very famous for not having much fun, to the extent where they not only didn't go to parties, but they gave away much of their fortune. And then, this is the most famous example. Hang on. John D. Rockefeller made his children wear hand-me-down clothes.
Yeah, I know.
So he was again almost the perfect Puritan in his personal life.
He only had one child, but
his son, right?
But he had five grandchildren.
Okay.
And somehow he conveyed to them, those five grandchildren, Nelson Rockefeller and so forth. I've often remarked on this, a poor boy's attitude.
Yep.
And that there's nothing wrong with that. That sounds like a fine scheme. Carnegie, on the other hand, had a castle in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Which he hid out in during the Homestead Strike, sending to, what's his name, Frick, orders by telegram, so that he could claim afterwards that, hey, I had nothing to do with
it. To shoot the strikers.
I was in Scotland. Oh, geez, terrible. The Frick, God, I wish he hadn't done that.
But that sounds more like a fortress for him than a pleasure palace. It was a means to escape the angry proletariat than a place to go have fun and pleasure.
Well, but he went there too to give pleasure. They gave away all their fortune. there is something religiously analogous in that fact about rich people in the United States. Andrew Carnegie wrote famously in 1987, I think, an essay called The Gospel of Wealth.
I was going to ask you about this.
That's one of the books that Carnegie was one of the people who my father studied in his PhD dissertation called American Conservatives in the Age of Enterprise. And my father, being a FDR kind of person in 1950, just was scornful of this crap, and that's just bad. Mm-hmm. Although it's a very, very good book. Yeah, and yet other highly religious bourgeois worldwide don't do it. So there is something peculiarly American to it.
That's interesting.
In France, they're all Catholics. They all say
that's
Catholics.
That's right. That's interesting.
And they never give a dime to anything.
Just so quickly, people understand, the Gospel of Wealth, Andrew Carnegie's famous essay, calls for capitalists to do what we're talking about. Give away your wealth and serve as the great fathers of society, uplift the masses by giving away your money.
He said, a man who dies rich dies thus disgraced.
You know the essay.
I know the essay pretty well. And
so pretty puritanical.
It depends what you mean by puritanical. I suppose it is.
So accumulation, right, according to the Puritans, mm-hmm. Was never intended for one's own
to make
advantage.
A family.
Yes.
For the next nine centuries.
To be invested in the community, God's community.
To be invested in God's community, not in the family understood in France as if I make a lot of money, I found a dynasty.
And not invested in personal ostentation or personal luxury?
Well, I guess not, although these people live pretty well. I mean, there's a very interesting book by, I'm going to forget his name. Oh, Bernard Balin.
Oh, sure.
Historian at Harvard.
Great historian.
He was.
Yeah.
I think he's...
But yeah, he's been
dead
for a while, but he was one of the
not
top
too long.
Five American historians, for sure. Brilliant.
In my opinion, too. Yeah. And he was a pal of my dad's. They played poker
okay.
and everything.
Okay.
And his last book, I think, was this short book contrasting big estates in the United States with those in England.
Haven't read that.
And he made the point. I lost the book shortly after I had read it, so I can't show it to you. But he made the really good point. He said, look, the castles and estates of the English rich and aristocracy, real aristocracy, were immensely bigger than anything any American. You go to you go to Monticello.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
Washington was the most successful planter in Virginia. It's often forgotten. His house is big, but it's nothing like these things you can go visit in England.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this big, and I don't think he explains it in Puritan terms. I don't think he'd be that naive because he was an actual student of the Puritans, but there's something about America that makes, maybe it's the come to think of it, maybe it's the egalitarianism of Americans. Now, these are slave owners, I have to admit.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain...
Among the landed elite whites,
yeah,
they're egalitarian.
They're egalitarian with
that's true, though,
slaves.
And they have an egalitarian ideology, certainly.
They have an egalitarian ideology.
Declaration of Independence.
All men are created
that's
equally,
right.
said
that's
he.
That's right.
With, and he owned, you know, 50 or 100 slaves.
So it was a bit of a contradiction there.
To put it mildly.
But publicly, yes,
yeah.
egalitarian.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
been our official
and,
religion.
And it has. Of the people, by the people, for the people,
yeah.
keeps getting reinforced. I mean, it's stronger in Australia than it is here. Much stronger.
The egalitarianism?
Oh, boy. Hmm. They're really egalitarian.
Oh, really?
Oh, my word, are they.
Huh. Cut
down the tall poppies, they say.
So the squaring of liberalism, classical liberalism, mm-hmm. with egalitarianism is a tricky thing, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. Because if you have real liberalism, not crony capitalism mm-hmm. or the oil companies taking over the government or something, but real, I have to be careful of the time. No, we were okay. Then people can enter occupations right. and trades. And just as you said about the competitive character of the Teamsters.
She's referring to my dissertation on Jimmy Hoffa, which we talked about before we started rolling here. Yeah,
and how it was, there are truck drivers in every industry, and if you organize them into a union, you're having to compete with the industrial union right there.
That's right.
The United Auto Workers or whatever it is.
That's my book.
So
right.
so you're having constant competition
yeah.
all around.
Yeah.
There must be other occupations similar to that.
It's beautiful to hear a serious historian articulate my thesis. That's the first time I've ever heard that. Well, I've never heard an academic historian articulate my thesis like that. Thank you for that.
Well, because they think in left-right terms. They're not thinking analytically. Yeah. Most historians have no theory of anything.
It's correct.
Now, I knew...
They're antiquarians, right?
They're antiquarians.
Which means storytellers.
Well, not even storytellers.
Or collectors of information.
That's what we used to call them in faculty meetings. We didn't like them.
Yeah, exactly. They're
still
antiquarians.
Just antiquarians. And whereas there are a few, like Bill McNeil at Chicago, whom I knew, who's able to think theoretically about history in a brilliant way. Yeah. Most historians are just collectors of facts.
Isn't it depressing? I found that to be
depressing.
The case at Columbia, where there was an open, outright, explicit hostility to theory. I mean, they would sneer at the word theory.
Of course they did. Whereas in economics, they sneer at the word philosophy.
Yeah.
So an economist who wants to dismiss an argument says, well, that's pretty philosophical, isn't it? As though being philosophical was kind of an idiot.
Incredible. I mean, people aren't aware that our academic departments are full of anti-intellectuals.
Wait, look.
That's what that is.
Here's the test.
God.
Can you have a real conversation like you and I are having now, where I always think of it this way, that there's something in the middle between us that we're both working on.
Yeah.
That's when you know you're having a real conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
The one person pushes it a little bit, and then the other person.
Yeah.
That's a real conversation. It's highly creative.
Yes.
Conversation is creative. It's not just entertainment. It's scientifically and emotionally and all kinds of other ways creative.
Productive, yeah.
But try to get a conversation going like that in an academic department, and you can't.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Harry Truman said, and an expert is someone who doesn't want to learn anything new, because then he wouldn't be an expert.
Mm-hmm. Puts himself out of business.
Yeah. Whereas at my idea of a great university, namely the University of Chicago, where I taught for 12 years, there you could.
Yeah.
And whereas at Harvard, where my father taught, they were at the long table at the faculty club, where all the kind of elite of the Harvard faculty would hang out. And if you weren't kind of invited to the long table, you knew that you weren't part of the elite. Mm-hmm. Anyway, according to my dad's account, they never talked about anything except baseball, basketball in season, and I don't know, gardening or something. I don't know what the hell. They didn't, whereas at Chicago, my most extreme example of this was at St. John's in Santa Fe, college there.
Great college.
It is a great college.
The Great Books College.
The Great Books College. And I was there in a to speak, and there for a couple of days. I thought it was my duty to go to breakfast with the students, and I could do that, so I did. And I sat down with this kid, sophomore or something, and within 2 minutes we were talking about Aristotle. And it didn't happen at Harvard, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. So in part, or maybe in large part, that's because they all think alike on the major issues, right?
They want to believe they do, and they get angry if you show signs of disputing what they
believe. They control hiring and firing and promotion, they self-replicate.
Within economics, I've got a reputation as a critic, as a pain in the neck, because I keep seeing bizarre scientific practices that don't make any sense. One of them is called tests of statistical significance. Now, I'm a quantitative person. I love numbers. I want many scientific questions or intellectual questions are answerable with numbers. Okay, I got it. But this test is a highly little teeny piece of machinery, which now the American Statistical Association has turned against officially.
Mm-hmm.
Economists haven't heard this, but for 30 years I've been telling economists, guys, you might as well use the numbers in the Manhattan phone directory to decide things, or a Ouija board, or one of those old magic eight balls. This is useless for science. It doesn't do what you think it does. They think that numbers have their own interpretation inside them, which is no more true of numbers than it is true of words.
So this, you're a segue.
And it irritates them. They just get angry at me.
You're a champion of science.
I am.
Yes. Okay. So this is the other question I've been wanting to ask you for 5 years, and it'll be the last question here. That seems to me to be possibly at odds with your own personal history. You know where I'm going with this?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, so I'm thinking, first of all, I was going to ask you actually about sort of contemporary campus politics, what's been going on. It was really good to talk about sort of the uniformity, the homogeneity of the ideologies on campuses, and the lack of intellectual curiosity, really.
Curiosity,
right? Terrible. So that's great. We did that.
I mean, I know lots of exceptions.
Sure, but now we have, in the last 4 or 5 years, we have this upsurge of all this, what's now called social justice warrior stuff, blah, blah, blah. But I think, you know, at the core of that, there's been stuff on race and stuff on sexual assault, but then also the trans movement has been a part of this, right? And their claim, so I've heard, you know, from this assortment of undergraduates and some of their faculty enablers, but is that I was born this way. I was born, it's an essentialist claim, right? I was born in the wrong body, right? But it makes an essentialist claim. And then they also often make a claim about the rest of us, right?
Yeah.
You are that gender and that means this or that about you, right?
Yeah, I know.
So in other words, I think what they're doing is, well, I know, I'm quite sure they're throwing out the original claims made by feminists
that
gender
right.
is a social construct. And they're
That's
actually going back to essentialism. Okay, good. So
they're essentialists and I get just crazy about them. I think it's so bloody silly. When they know, they don't even know that their gender is socially constructed.
Okay, cool.
They don't even know that they, and it's so irritating.
Okay, I wasn't sure where you're going to go with this. I thought, well, so that, doesn't science tell you that you're a man?
No. Well, it depends.
It did.
It sort of depends what you mean by science. If you mean biology, sure. Every cell of my body says XY, XY.
Okay.
Now, maybe in some future world, we'll be able to change all that. That'd be great.
Okay.
I'd rather have XX genes. But, you know, so that's the cards I'm dealt. But what's this? I was born in Boston. Does that mean I stay in Boston all my... Or not born, but I raised in Boston. Mm-hmm. Does that make me essentially a Bostonian?
Right.
So does that mean I can't change and move to Iowa or
You can't
to
change
Chicago?
Your accent. You can't change your sports team.
That's right,
you can't
that's
change
right.
your favorite politicians.
I got so disturbed by the 1967 World Series when the damn Cardinals beat the Red Sox that I gave up on baseball for decades. God.
Good woman.
Good God. Lou Brock, that creep. I hate him. Anyway.
Wow. Ancient grievances.
Ancient grievances.
That's what Unregistered's all about, ladies
that's
and gentlemen.
That's right. But that's the point. You're born. You're born to, I don't know. You were born to radical left-wing parents, and now you're not. You're not a fascist,
That's
right. but you're not radically left-wing.
That's right.
I was my family. my mother and father were, as I said, FDR liberals and the terrible American perversion of that word. And but my father grew gradually more conservative as he got older. 1968, he comes home from voting, and my mother looks at him and says, he looked kind of funny. She said, you voted for Nixon. And he said, my vote is private. So people change. Mm-hmm. They, thank God, in a free society, they can change. They can change their social presentation. I can't have had the history of a woman. I transitioned at age 53. I wish I'd been able to transition at age 12. That would have been more satisfactory. Mm. But, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. Those are the, when I was at age 12, it was 1954. There was nothing to be done. So I was a guy, and I was a regular guy. I'm the captain of my football team. I was a guard.
Mm.
Kind of a small school, I have to admit.
I was going to say.
Still not. I have a friend, a close friend, who was an all-state high school guard in Ohio.
Offensive guard. That's what you were.
Blocker. We played both sides.
Okay.
It was not a skill position, but right. but Dick, yes, it was a skill position for him. Mm. So I don't rag about it with him. But so I, you know, you play the cards you're dealt, but that doesn't mean you can't win the game or you know.
Or play another game.
Play another game.
There you go.
Come on. This is the core of liberalism, that people are not essentially plowmen.
Huh.
They're not frozen as milkmaids just because they were born into it. And it's the promise of a liberal society, having a go, as the English say. You're allowed to. I've been playing the last 6 months or so with the word permission, because that's, I think, crucial.
Good
to the whole, not equality of opportunity. That gets very confusing, because then we want to transfer a lot of money to people who don't have good opportunities. And we want to cut down the tall poppies, as the Australians say. That is, if you're smart, we want to drive nails into your head until you're as stupid as everyone else, and then it'd be equal. That's to make equality the goal, and that's the equality of end state, which I think is not sensible. None of us is equal to another. We're in soul and in politics, we should be equal, but we're not equal. You know, some people can sing, some people can't, some people can play, can be the opening batsman for England in cricket, and blah, blah, blah. And it's great, it's wonderful that I can go watch the opening batsman. That I can watch Ian, both of them, who was an all-rounder. wow. for England.
Your knowledge knows no bounds, I must say. This is impressive. Even cricket.
Well, okay. I can, as my mentor at Harvard, Alexander Gershengorn, did, I can always drag the conversation over to something he knows about. He did that all the time. He loved to talk about the defenestration of Prague.
Oh, my.
Which was the beginning of the 30 Years' War.
Okay.
And he knew all about it. Yeah, he was an economist, but he knew all about the defenestration of Prague. So every time you talked about something, he'd gradually move it over to the defenestration of Prague.
Good distraction tactic. Yeah. So liberal, wow. So I've never thought that liberalism might be the friend of
equality.
Anti-essentialism in a sense.
That's an interesting example of what we said earlier, that conversation is creative, because I haven't thought about it either.
Yeah.
I had in the back of my mind. I have a new afterword of my the account of my transition called Crossing, that came out just this August, and I have an afterword where I talk about what happened since 1999 when it was first published, and I do end with a kind of a liberal appeal that is it a free society or not? I was attacked really astonishingly violently in this conservative Catholic publication called First Things.
I know Crisis.
Yeah, but
similar.
This one is terrible.
What were they mad at?
And the guy attacked me for my transgenderism. He just hated it. Well. And I said in a letter to the editor, I said, well, look, do you believe in free will or not?
Mm.
Are you a Christian or not?
Mm.
Yeah, apparently it's not.
You went deep on them.
I went deep on them.
It's your tendency. So I think there has been something sitting between us here the last hour and a half, and I want to thank you for helping me build it.
Good.
This has been really productive and really wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Come again. We can keep doing this.
I would love
Every week we can do it.
Let's do it. Thank you.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University at 30 to 40% off, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for listening.